Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle is one of the nation's most valuable resources for military history. With records and archives going back more than two centuries, the Army Heritage and Education Center is often the source for historians, authors of books, and producers of documentaries on military history. And at a time when more Americans are researching their family histories, AHEC can also be a great source for individuals who are looking to learn more about a family member's military background. That will be one of the focuses on today's program. Joining us is Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, who is the director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Mr. Mangelsdorf, welcome back to the program.
Scott, thanks. It's great to be back again.
Also joining us is Richard Baker, a senior technical information specialist. Mr. Baker, good to see you.
Scott, a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners today.
And Lindsay Strell is the outreach coordinator at AHEC. Ms. Strell, good to see you again.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, this is one of those things that the more you hear, you think, well, what about my grandfather or my father or my aunt, my uncle? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7555. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Now, a little bit of background here. When Jeffrey Mangelsdorf was on the program the last time a couple of months ago, after the program, we got to talking, and I showed him a newspaper clipping about Corporal Clarence Patton, who is my second cousin. And the newspaper clipping talked about how Corporal Patton had been awarded a Distinguished Service Cross during World War II in 1944 and had been killed in action. But there was a lot of information missing from that newspaper clipping that I just wanted to know. So Mr. Mangelsdorf went back, gave that information to Rich Baker, and you contacted me and said, why don't we use this as an example of what we do all the time when we research at AHEC? And is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, that's a pretty good setup. We were talking about D-Day on the last
that's
program,
right.
and you mentioned you had a family connection to it, and that actually is quite common. We get these kinds of requests for information all the time. It's not our primary mission, but it's something that we're able to help people out with because everybody is looking for some background on what the family did. And quite often, our veterans, even the surviving veterans, don't talk a lot about their experiences, especially in combat.
Well, when you say it's not your primary mission, before we get into Corporal Patton, what is your primary mission?
Well, fundamentally, we're at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. We're an integral part of the Army War College. And one of our main missions is to run the Army's archives. And so in order to support a study of strategic leadership and in how the Army has evolved, one of the spin-off benefits is that we have an incredibly rich collection of materials, whether it's archival documents or books going back to before we even had an army, photographs, map sheets. We've got a very diverse and rich collection of material that then allows us to go back in and research out and answer questions very much like the one you posed for us.
Lindsay Strell, as the outreach coordinator, is all this material that Mr. Mangelsdorf just mentioned, is it all open to the public, available to the public?
Most of the stuff is available to the public. So there are some things that are classified that, you know, the Army will use, but the public can't. And we basically, teachers, students, everyone can come access the material.
Mm-hmm. So there actually is some classified material in Carlisle. What is it usually? I mean, obviously you can't tell.
Can't.
I mean, obviously you can't tell us what it is, but generally.
Some of that material, so certainly the more recent material that we have is still classified from ongoing operations. And then we've got collections of material that goes back many years, some of which was originally classified and still might contain sensitive information. And there's a thorough vetting process for before we release that material to the public.
Are you do you have permission? Are you able to look at classified material?
Yes. Most of our workforce there at USA HEC goes through a security clearance process and vetting and has access to the classified material.
Oh, I got off track here. I was following your lead. So let's talk a little bit about my second cousin. It's my mother's first cousin, and I'm assuming that is second cousin. My Aunt Vali was his mother. A little bit of background that I was able to find. Clarence Patton was born in 1913 near Mortonville in Chester County. Mortonville is in East Vallefield Township, just outside of Coatesville. Clarence Patton was born out of wedlock. His mother was not married when he was born. So she was sent to live with her grandparents, which probably, I think it was 20 or 30 miles away. But think about the context of the times, 1913. And so we're skipping over a lot. Don't know a whole lot about Clarence Patton between 1913 and 1941. But he was working as a truck driver for a hardware store in Downingtown. And the reason I tell that story is because there are very few countries in the world where someone with that kind of background can rise to become a hero, awarded this Distinguished Service Cross. So that brings us to Clarence Patton's military service. And Rich Baker, this is where you come in.
I received your request and the very nice collage of family newspaper clippings you sent. You're right about items not being included on there. In the readings here, they don't identify the unit that he was assigned to, and they didn't identify the town where the casualties occurred and stuff. That was all part of security. Mm-hmm. Anything like that being left out could give the enemy a lead as to who was where over there.
Even the Coatesville Record newspaper in 1944 had X's where these actions took place.
Mm-hmm. And that was standard procedure because you did have infiltrators and others who were with the Axis regimes that may have been of interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was passed on to me, and I've done a little research for you, and I've brought you a few things along to take with you. And if I may, let me launch a little bit here.
Okay.
One of the first things I do is I go out to a website called the American Battle Monuments Commission, ABMC. And ABMC is that agency that is responsible for the maintenance of all of the American cemeteries overseas. And that is where your relative Clarence was interned over in France at the Lorraine American Cemetery. One of the nice things about their website is that for all the internees and or the missing in action from World War II, they will give you some details that are essential. Name, rank, the assigned unit. And that was a key for us here because our records are relevant to unit histories, not the individual soldiers. And basically what I identified is that he was a member of the 25th Reconnaissance Squadron of the 4th Armored Division. This was a spearhead unit. This was among the units that were on the release from the Normandy enclave, and the breakout and run across France were out front. And reconnaissance squadrons were in front of everybody else. So he was involved along with his co-workers and his other soldiers in tip-of-the-spear type operations there. One of the things I do also is I go out and I try to identify more information about the soldier themselves. There's a wonderful website that the National Archives has put out in the last 10 years, and it does something that we weren't able to do a longer time ago, and that is get an identification and a serial number for the individual soldier. And with that, we're able to help people go further, maybe with the National Archives records, etc. What I found here for Clarence is that he was enlisted in June of 41. So actually, he was in the Army before the war started. Why? There were drafts. 1939, 1940, into 41, there was a limited draft that took place. And basically, he was drafted into the Army. His serial number tells me that. From that standpoint, once we had that and a serial number and the information, we were able to go ahead and start our research into the actual unit itself. Where the unit went, the soldier was assumed to be with them to a large degree. And in that case here, there's a number of resources. One of them is the World War II Order of Battle, published by a gentleman named Stanton. I call that a Bible book. I've got my own copy. It's on the table there. It's a daily reference to go to, easily accessible to most people through their local libraries. And what we found there was the entry first offered the reconnaissance squadron. It was originally formed down in Texas back in 43. Eventually, it was disbanded in Germany in March and May of 46. So they did actually, after the war, serve occupation duty also. And it went to France in January of 44, went into, it went to England in January of 44. So they were there 6 months before the Normandy operations. Went into France on July of 44. That's when the 4th would have been sent in, the 4th Armored Division. And basically served through the various campaigns to include not only Germany, but the Ardennes, the Alsace, Battle of the Bulge, main campaign across France, and of course the Normandy campaigns.
And by the way, 4th Armored Division was under General George Patton. I don't think, I've never found that there is any relationship. I don't know for sure, but it's General George Patton and Clarence Patton.
I'm certain that Clarence received a number of comments about
that. I'm sure he did, too. So, yeah.
In that respect. So Stanton's Order of Battle does go further. It does provide details about the division also. Many times you have to look at the divisional records to get an indication of what the subunit was doing, because sometimes history just isn't produced, written, or available to us at the AHEC on a more subordinate unit. So I brought you along some material here that you'll be able to look at depth at your own convenience. But the richness of our collections is that we don't have individual service records for the soldiers, but we have unit histories and unit materials. And what I did is I went looking at some of the 4th Division and 25th Reconnaissance Squadron materials that we hold. A lot of the emphasis comes back to the division, and extracting from divisional histories helps to fill those X's on your newspaper clippings, the unknowns involved there. Have I been able to get it absolutely exact? No.
Can I stop you right now? Because I have something I have to do, but I assume we're going to go to August 1944.
We're working our way there.
Okay. All right. Let me take a break here, and then we'll come back. But again, this is the kind of thing that you can do on your own with the help of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. That's our lesson for today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Join us for APM Reports on Education with a set of 3 new hour-long documentaries that will examine how predictive analytics are reshaping the college experience, how schools teach reading, and a look at efforts for children in unstable housing to do well in school. Join us for APM Reports on Education next week, Monday to Wednesday at 9 a.m. on WITF. That's right. It will be filling in the time that normally where Smart Talk would be, those documentaries next week, Monday through Wednesday at 9 a.m., so be sure to tune in. On today's program, we're talking about services that are offered, resources at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. Our guest today, Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, who is the director, Richard Baker, Senior Technical Information Specialist, and Lindsay Strell, Outreach Coordinator, all at the U.S. AHAC, and talking about My Second Cousin as an example of the kind of information that you can find, but eventually we're going to go on and talk about a lot more that you can find at AHAC, the kind of resources and information. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Corporal Clarence Patton, 1944, 4th Armored Division, 25th Reconnaissance. We've made it up to 1944. Rich Baker, go ahead.
All righty. Well, part of the reason for us being here is that we didn't have all the details. You didn't have all the details in your newspaper clippings you provided. So my research, I've taken it to the point where we've been able to look at the activities of the division And when you do the studies and look at the unit historical material for the divisions, it very often filters down to the subordinate units. And in his case, he was part of the division's reconnaissance squadron. They were out front, tip of the spear, probing and looking for the enemies, and on occasion finding them. Of course, being out front like that, the backup was usually a distance behind them. In this case here, looking at the award of his Distinguished Service Cross, as you had mentioned it.
Okay, this is the citation for the Distinguished Service Cross. The citation which accompanied the award reads as follows: "For extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations against an armed enemy, on 29 August 1944, a platoon of reconnaissance troops of which Corporal Patton was a member advanced as the leading element of Combat Command XXX, Armored Division, on the town of XXX. The platoon was immediately counterattacked by an enemy force which outnumbered them by more than 20 to 1. Corporal Patton stood fast in his advanced position and killed more than 20 of the enemy with small arms fire. He so inspired his men by his conspicuous bravery that they held their positions against overwhelming odds, killed more than 150 of the enemy, and held the town for over 2 hours until relieved by friendly infantry. Following this heroic action, Corporal Patton continued to serve with his reconnaissance platoon until he was killed in action 12 September 1944 while engaged in hand-to-hand combat with the enemy at XXS." So let's go back to the actions for which he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross.
What I've done here is pulled together information that covers the several days around that time frame to get an idea for you as to what the unit was encountering. They were involved in the move across France, one village to another, one meeting with the enemy forces to another. A lot of roadblocks set up. Reconnaissance was out there trying to figure out what it was that the main units coming up were going to encounter. And I believe he was a member of Combat Command B, by the way, of the 4th Armored Division. And on the 29th of August, they actually, according to the history, had very little contact with the enemy. However, on the day before that, the 28th, they had significant contact with the enemy. And in looking at the history here, I'm of the opinion that his actual time frame for the award of the decoration may have been within that day, that 24-hour period of the 28th through the 29th for some night activities. They had gotten themselves into a position in the front where they had taken a village and the Germans counterattacked. By all appearances here, it seems to be some very significant Axis units that did so, possibly the SS involved in that. So very elite, capable organization they were coming up against. And the battle ensued, and the description there you provide shows the extent of what Clarence and his troops in the 25th encountered and how they defended against it.
Now, where was that?
At this point, it's coming down to one particular town, and it is, one moment.
Yeah, you have a couple pages there of information.
Yeah, there's a couple pages of information. They were northeast of Chalons, France, across the Marne River, and near the city of Marie. I actually have a map for you that points this out, and I've highlighted it so you can trace that along the line. The Marne, in particular, is kind of ironic in a sense. They were in the area where some of the heaviest fighting for American forces occurred in World War One. So they were...
World War Two, you mean?
No,
World War One.
Kind of an ironic situation there in that respect. And basically, they were taking one village after another, and Chalons and Marie are the villages they were encountering and pursuing on from there. Again, the map can be more helpful in showing that out.
So this happened at the end of August, two weeks later, 12 September 1944, Corporal Patton was killed. And again, when you look at that newspaper clipping, it does not identify where he was killed. You are not able to tell me exactly where that is, but... Again, you can tell where the unit was.
We could figure out where the unit was, yes.
Okay,
there are documents for people to obtain, not from us, but from other resources that we can direct them to. That can be more insightful and concise. But in this case, on 12 September of 44, they had completed the bridging of the Mosul River and were moving out and crossing that river, and Combat Command A and Combat Command B were making access across the river into the various areas. And the it appears that the units were operating in the area of St. Genevieve.
And where is that?
Is a name that comes up. So we're talking about having crossed the Mosul into the more eastern areas of France. And basically,
so they went quickly across France. If you go by from July until September of 1944,
that's what broke the back of the Axis forces in France at that time, was the rapidity of movement. It proved the concepts of armor as an independent force rather than being tied directly to an infantry unit itself. Infantry moves on its feet. Armor needed to move more quickly. It was the American version of the Blitzkrieg, is what it amounts to. And Patton, as one of the Third Army's, as the Third Army commander, was instrumental in pushing that forward. And
George Patton,
George
not Clarence.
George Patton. And Clarence was there as again, tip of the spear, front of the reconnaissance units, helping to probe and get the units through those various areas. And on the 12th, they encountered an event where, in that hand-to-hand combat, he was a casualty. So that takes him all the way up to the area south of Metz, south of to where France and Luxembourg come together to a degree.
So you answered a lot of questions for me, but again, this wasn't just about me. This was an example of the kind of information that you can find. Rich, you said to me before the program that this is rather routine for the kind of research that you do. Is there anything that sticks out to you about Clarence Patton?
A, that he received the Distinguished Service Cross.
There were just over 5,000 awarded in World War II. And by the way, you know, we've talked about General George Patton. When there's a list of World War II Distinguished Service Cross recipients, Clarence's name is listed right before George Patton. So the Pattons, again, whether we're related, I don't know, but there is that. Something else to add to that, Clarence's half-brother, Paul Howitt, was also killed in action 2 weeks after Clarence was. So my aunt, my great aunt, lost both or two of her three sons within 2 weeks. But Mr. Mangelsdorf, first of all, Rich, thank you very much for that information. Mr. Mangelsdorf, as we're going through there and I see all the information that Rich Baker has, I'm thinking to myself, boy, that seems like a lot of work, but this is the kind of information that is provided to individuals, authors, historians, documentary makers all the time, right?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the materials that come from the Rich collection, and it's pretty expansive as well. And literally, if you lined up the shelves, we have over 5 miles of shelves filled with boxes of material, like what Rich has pulled out for you. And it runs the full gamut from written unit reports to the map sheets that he was sharing with you. And collectively, that's what allows us to kind of paint that picture, to put things into context for people. It's something that we do routinely for people to help them out. And as you heard, it's our strength. While we have a wonderful collection, our real strength is the individuals that work there, the expert services that people like Rich Baker and others around him provide to help people negotiate their way through that 5 miles of material.
How does the military use the resources that you have at AHAC?
In very similar fashion. So it runs the full gamut from researching individual projects to answering questions that come out of the top of the Army on a routine basis. As you know, as an example, we just changed over the Chief of Staff of the Army, the senior uniformed guy in the Army. General Milley moved aside. General McConville just came in last week as the Chief of Staff of the Army. And as part of that transition process, people ask routine questions like, how did the last guy think about this? Or how did the last several leaders think about Army transformation or modernization or readiness. And we're able to answer those questions by sending PhD-level historians into the archives to pull out, glean material. One of our richest collections actually is the personal papers of the chiefs of staff of the Army. And we literally have hundreds of those in the back. And so as questions come up, we're able to answer them.
Is military strategy today used, some of those resources, are they cited or are they researched to be used today?
Absolutely. And because we are part of the Army War College, a lot of our material forms the basis of case studies that the students use as they're preparing for moving on to strategic leadership positions in the Army and for the nation.
Mm. And that's actually, we had a listener ask that same question, how you develop current plans for future operations. And by the way, if you're just tuning in, you know, we went through Corporal Patton's military history as an example of the kind of information you can get at the Army Heritage and Education Center. But if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, the archives. You mentioned that you have records that go back even before there was a U.S. Army. What's the oldest thing in your collection?
The oldest book in our collection is dated 1494. You remember, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Right, yeah. But that wasn't 494, but yeah, it doesn't rhyme.
Yeah, I know. And that's the oldest book that we've identified. It's a beautiful piece. If you are adept at reading Old Latin, you're welcome to come in and have a gander at it. It is actually a reissuing of material developed by a gentleman named Vestigius.
Vestigius.
There you go. Out of the Roman era. He wrote about military history, but military practices of the Roman period. Of course, it was lost with the fall of the Roman Empire, etc. A lot of it was re-established, redeveloped, and used in the later Renaissance periods by the military forces of the time. Keep in mind, they were not national forces. They right. Paid for forces, and they found his works and they brought it out and utilized it, and so he's become a part of strategy and planning, etc., for centuries now.
Really? See, that's my next question. Why would the U.S. Army want a book that was from 1494? What could they learn?
The old saying, there's nothing new under the sun. I bring that up to people's attention on many a basis. And practices that were entailed then of how to get men, and nowadays the women also, to work together as a combined military force, strategy is an important aspect of it. The fact that we probably have to go back over the years and look at how many times we fought over one particular piece of ground somewhere on the planet. Doesn't hurt to look at what was happening then as compared to now. And the aspect of knowing how it was done in the past. We don't know where we're going to go in the future if we don't have an idea of what we came through in the past. That's the key. Lessons learned. We help with finding those lessons that have been lost over the years.
Do you have items in the collection? Am I accurate in saying in the collection? Okay.
Yeah, that's perfect. And because it's such a diverse grouping of things, it's very tough to categorize it any one way. So the collection is a perfect reference.
Okay. We have a call from James in Harrisburg who anticipated my next question. Go ahead, James. We're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Great show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, I was just wondering how far back your records go. I had a grandfather who fought in the Continental Army with Washington, and I have some documentation, but I was wondering if I could expand on that through the records that you keep.
All right. Okay, well, thank you. What kind of documentation do you have?
Oh, that he was in the German regiment.
He was a Hessian.
No.
No?
No.
No, he was a German regiment. There was a German regiment that fought with the Continental Army.
Oh, right. Okay.
He
wasn't with the British then.
With Washington and fought at Trenton and...
Okay. Yeah, I jumped the gun there. Hey, thank you very much for your call, James. I don't want to put your ancestor on the enemy side on this radio program here this morning. So we just talked about the oldest thing you have in a collection, but James anticipated my question. I was going to ask if you have anything from George Washington in your collection.
We have materials relevant to the Revolutionary War. Primary sources are lean, to say the very least. The technology of the time dictated the administrative practices of the time. So today we have vast administrative practices, lots of records. Back then your technology was basically by horse or by foot, maybe by sail. So administrative records keeping kind of mirrored the technology of the time. He spoke of the German regiments.
Which I called a Hessian. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that, James.
Well, that's easily done.
I know.
They come out primarily of the Lancaster area to a large extent because of the heavy German concentration of immigrants and all that moved there. And basically, they formed separate regiments, generally under the control of Pennsylvania, to serve in the Revolutionary War. We can help with that. Records of the individuals, that's a qualified question, because many times the records are a listing on a muster roll. Well, unfortunately, there are few muster rolls as compared to how many there originally were in that respect. So yes, we can help with researching Revolutionary War, and it's an area of interest. So we encourage
that. All right, then that's a good segue into an area of interest. Mr. Mangelsdorf, Rick Atkinson coming. Rick Atkinson is a respected author. Talk about that. He's coming to the Mid-State here.
So he's coming. We've got him lined up to speak about his new book. In a moment, Lindsay will give you the real details on that. But Rick is one of our great researchers that comes frequently to delve into the material at the archives. And it's one of the great advantages of us, because we are really the reconvergence of library, archives, and museums and artifacts. And so collectively that fleshes things out. But he'll be up with us this next month, right, Lindsay?
September 18th. So Wednesday, 7:15.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the book and what he will be at AHAC to do.
Rick is starting a trilogy with the Revolutionary War. It's called The British Are Coming. This is part one that he's going to be speaking about. He'll come, give a talk for about an hour, and then the audience are able to ask him questions. Rick loves our archives, has spoken about it many times, so he pretty much makes a trip out of it to start his next book.
Mm-hmm. And that is something I did want to talk about during the program, is that, I mean, we focus in a lot on individuals and their family histories, but my guess is probably that is the least of how AHAC's collection is used. You often, probably every day, have historians, authors, producers of documentaries coming or accessing what's available digitally to get information on what they are doing, correct?
Right. We're open 10 to 5. You come in. It is a free resource to use. They look through our card catalog. I'm dating myself. Card catalog, our online catalog. And they can ask the CERC desk to pull the material, and they just go through the papers, looking what they need, finding their little tidbits of information. And we have everything from book authors to people making documentaries. Our photograph collection is quite extensive. We have the world's largest Civil War photographs. Ken Burns used that with his documentary. So we do have those types of people come use our archives every day.
Now, are the things you mentioned, how much of that is available online?
Right now,
at this point, that's a great question. At this point, of the entire collection, maybe about 2% is available online and readily accessible. We're just starting a major effort to digitize the holdings. We think at this point, we're in the first year of doing this. We conservatively think it's going to be about a 5 or 6 year effort to scan, photograph, and put online just the unclassified material that we have, and really just the unclassified manuscripts. a follow-on effort will start to pick up map sheets, photographs, some of the extensive audio and full motion video collections that we have.
Mm-hmm. So has Ken Burns, Lindsay, actually been to AHAC?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Depending on your statistics, 80 to 90% of his photographs that he uses for the Civil War documentary that's very popular came from our collection.
Really? Now, did he scan those on his own, or how did that
That was before my time.
Yeah.
So, in the meantime, before stuff is digitized and put up online, we do have a copy center. So, if people cannot make it to our facility and they know what they want specifically, they can call in and order through our copy center.
What are some of the well-known books and authors, others that have utilized AHAC?
From the Civil War standpoint, names like James McPherson come forth. We have a number of authors out of the Western Indian Wars periods that have written and used our resources. Of course, Mr. Atkinson, Max Hastings out of England, one of the best English historians, an opinion obviously, but Max Hastings, Sorley, Army historian of background and renown, has used our materials. Many, many people that publish come there and utilize them, whether it's a PhD student getting ready to do their doctorate, or it's a author, scholar, or family member doing a history thereafter.
Mm. You know, we commemorate certain dates and times in history. Mr. Mangelsdorf, as you mentioned, the last time you were on the program was the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And I wonder, is there more interest? Do you have more people coming for research or trying to get information around big dates like that?
Yeah, we see an uptick, a surge of people coming around for specific events. And then also you see generational shifts as relatives start to approach end of life or have recently passed. There's an interest that gets spawned of that as well.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. One of the shows we're working on for next week is the U.S. Census and here in Pennsylvania, how there will be outreach efforts and why it is so important that everyone be counted here in Pennsylvania and across the country. If you want an outlook of some of the conversations we're working on, go to WITF.org/smarttalk. You can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. Today, we're talking about some of the services, some of the information research provided by the United States Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle, a great resource for many people. Our guest, Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, director of AHAC, Richard Baker, senior technical information specialist, and Lindsay Strell, outreach coordinator at AHAC. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org or on Twitter. We are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. If your question, I encourage you to get it in quickly because we have about 12 minutes or so left in the program for today. Let's take a phone call from Veronica in Lancaster County. Veronica, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to know, I know people have a lot of paperwork that they don't know what to do with and sometimes decide to donate it to historical societies. Does the Army Heritage and Education Center ever get new photos from Civil War soldiers?
It's a great question because I'm sure there are a lot of families out there that have had them for years, maybe don't know what to do with them. What about that?
Well, we do receive donations. That's the core, the basis of what is at Carlisle. It's those memoirs, diaries, papers, photographs, etc., that the individuals produced over the years that give us the foundation of what we can provide to others. We occasionally do receive some Civil War photos. It's a rarity nowadays because of obviously the circumstances that exist in the public world for those. We have a process to where we do have to have the originals, and that's part of an impediment on occasion, but the collection can be added to. It's a matter of just coordinating with us.
How much information do you need? Do you need people in the photographs to be identified, where it was taken, the photograph was taken, or just what?
Our motto is telling the Army story one soldier at a time. So the collections management's like to have a somewhat of a collective story to follow. So if someone brings in, they go, I have this jacket, I don't know who it belonged to. We probably have hundreds of those types of, you know, World War II like jackets. Mm-hmm. But if you come in and you say, my relative, I don't know much about him, but he was from this division and I have all this other stuff, then they would most likely take
it. Now, it is the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Do you have Confederate items?
Yes, we do. We hold a fair smidgen, you might say, of Confederate-related information. A lot of it is secondary, of course, but we can provide insight into Confederate service members also. Mm-hmm.
But I guess technically was the Confederate Army wasn't considered part of the U.S. Army?
No, they were considered the other side of the hill in that respect. When Richmond fell, a lot of the records of the Confederate government were captured, were taken to Washington and held for a long time. And eventually, they disseminated records back out to the individual states, but kept copies thereof down in Washington, D.C., and we piggyback on some of that. And we've had individuals who've contributed material to us for their relatives. No.
Brings up the question, do you have records and archives from the enemy of the United States in other wars? Like, for example, Nazi Germany, the Spanish-American War.
Yes, we do.
So we do. It's because fundamentally we're an academic institution, and part of studying conflict is understanding, you know, multiple perspectives on what was happening. And so one of the things that helps us do that is have material from what ends up being opposing forces to the United States. So, yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. A couple emails we've received. Steven says, General Patton did or still does have family in this area. I learned that by accident at a downsizing sale several years ago. The two ladies selling their items mentioned that they had several items stored for the general's nephew who lived in this area. So maybe General George Patton did have some relatives in this area. And I wanted to, and I don't know whether I'm pronouncing this correctly or not, Dyer's Compendium. Mm-hmm. Is good for Civil War research. Is there a compendium that is good for the Revolutionary War research?
No, not in the
what
same...
What is a compendium, by the way?
Well, a compendium is a combination and a collection of information. Dyer's Compendium, for example, has multiple entries on the Civil War Union units that participated. So it's a quasi-order of battle, really, for the Civil War from the federal side. For the Revolutionary War, again, comes back to the time frame, the technology. There's no real similar item that I would compare for the Revolutionary War.
A few years ago, when Ken Burns produced his series, his documentary on World War II called The War, and his production company asked local stations like WITF, local public stations like WITF, to talk with local World War II veterans and even the families that were back home. We did it. One of my favorite, probably the favorite project I ever worked on here, spoke with about 30 World War II veterans here in central Pennsylvania. But we were provided, this was for television, we were provided with DVDs. There was video of almost, and I want to say every single place that was mentioned by these veterans of where they were, Anzio in Italy, northern France, northern Africa, video from everywhere. When did the Army, well, first of all, I should ask the question, does the Army and the other branches of the military here in the United States video everything, shoot video of everything? And when did they start doing that? Is video available? Do you have video of a lot of these things?
So the Army has been collecting video and film of combat operations since the technology allowed. It's one of the phenomenal things about the Army is they're really an early adopter of technology as it comes along. So photographic collections, go back to the beginning of time, for all intents and purposes. Full motion video and film, absolutely. There's lots of material from World War II. You know, the Signal Corps was charged with capturing all of this and would put what we now call combat cameramen literally in frontline units. And so that's how you see footage captured from literally of as D-Day was unfolding. People hitting the beaches as the ramp drops, that was real film footage captured by soldiers whose job was to go out and record those things. And collectively, we have a fair amount of that material.
Jack emails us. He says, I'd like to thank the staff of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center for all the work they do and for all the great displays they have inside and out to help the public gain a small understanding of what it was like to serve in the Army, especially for the helicopter door gunner diorama that with the film footage playing in the background. Although the mannequin's uniform should be updated to Nomex flight suits and all leather boots instead of jungle fatigues and jungle boots, which was possibly what was worn in the very early days of the air crews. So those who have served want to make sure that everything is as accurate as possible.
The fun thing about Vietnam is depending
the
on...
The fun thing about
the
Vietnam.
I'm clearly a history kid. Is that depending on where you served, you could have a different experience of war. So sometimes we have a full fire base on our Army Heritage Trail, which is a walking tour of different things.
You see along I-81.
And a handful of veterans would be like, this isn't my Vietnam. This wasn't here. Well, we use photographic evidence to build our things. Our curators do a lot of research into what uniforms they wear, what, you know, what they built, what they were in. So depending on where you were in war, it might be a different experience. They do make mistakes sometimes. And they, if patrons, you know, bring this stuff up, they can give them the historic information, they will change it.
It leads to some fantastic conversations.
I'll bet.
Sometimes you just stumble upon. Individuals want to communicate to ensure that we are accurate in how we portray things. But then I find more fascinating the conversation within families that come across, where somebody's out with a grandfather who's seeing a setting, especially out on our walking trail, where we have 13 different macro exhibits or artifacts. It sparks a conversation. You can see people's faces change as they step back in time and then start to relay what their experiences were to family members.
Mm. You know, one of the things I've been thinking about throughout the program is what a great source this would be for education, teachers, and other educators. What is National History Day?
So educators use our materials a lot. They're teaching, you know, a conflict. They might be teaching Vietnam one or two times a year. And so they need that background information. We do have an educator's toolbox online that is curated for them. They can go on, get background information on things like Pearl Harbor and that kind of stuff. We also have, we're part of National History Day, which is basically the science fair of history. Our foundation heads it for the state. And they'll have a different topic each year. They have regional competition, state, and then national. So students will come in, learn about using primary sources based on their topic, actually get in our research center and do start their own research. And that's as young as middle school all the way up through high school.
Mm. We only have a minute left, and we've covered a lot of ground. But one quick question for you, Lindsay. What have students done in the past?
Rich would know more. He's worked with them.
For the National History Day program.
Yeah.
We've had students from across the country ask us for information on that. We're very happy to say that our little bits and helps have enabled many of them to go on to even the point of winning the national contest.
Mm.
So the subject ranges, some of these students do studies on materials that are PhD quality level subject interest. So it can range, it depends on what the concept is for the year. And it can range from studies of Civil War through service members' participation in combat, et cetera. Only thing that amazes me more than what we have is what they ask for.
I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, Richard Baker, Lindsay Strell from the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. For those who may be interested in learning more, Mr. Mangelsdorf, what can they do?
So certainly they can come by and see us anytime. Visit the website for immediate access to some material and directions on how to contact us more.
Thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I'll talk to you next week.